hands to ask question, or is it
Yes.
like, okay, then I'll raise my hand. Thanks.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to today's Google Search Central SEO Office Hours Hangout. My name is John Mueller. I am a search advocate at Google here in Switzerland. And part of what we do are these office hour sessions where people can jump in and raise their hands and ask questions. And we have a bunch of questions also submitted on YouTube. But maybe we'll get started with the first ones here. Let's see. I'm not quite sure like how the order was originally because it swapped around a little bit, but I'll just go from the top. I'm sure we'll make it. Kamal.
Hi.
Hi.
We have an exam website. People added some exams and give the label for the exams. And Google indexes all the pages, all the label pages, like tag pages. And their role is filtering the exams based on the text, based on the topic. And Google indexes all the topics, you know, but is most of them include the same exams, like a duplicated page. And we canonicalized these URLs firstly, but it caused a lot of crawling time for Google. For example, we used the third-party tool to crawl all the pages. It was about 100,000 pages. Then we give a no index on robot text, and the crawling time decreased, and it is very fine. But we want to remove some of these pages which indexed by Google. For example, we find them on search results, what we don't want to do that. How we can do that? We gave no index and Google cannot access. Should we remove them one by one or?
I would just leave them as no index. And it's what will happen is over time when we recrawl those pages, they will drop out. But that can happen maybe, I don't know, take a couple of months. But it's not that we would crawl those pages more just because of the no index. Essentially, when we crawl them, we will see the no index and then we will drop them. And usually, if we see a no index, then we would not crawl them that often. And I think with something in the order of 100,000 pages, it just takes a while, but it's not like super gigantic and impossible to recrawl.
Does it affect negatively to our SEO performance in
No.
terms of Google see that these are duplicate pages but canonicalized at the same time? Now
No.
is an index.
No, it's perfectly fine. It's purely a matter of kind of the crawling side of things. If we see that they're duplicate, then we will try to treat them as duplicates, and we will just focus on one canonical URL for them. And yeah, so from that point of view, I will just let it be reprocessed and drop out on its own.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. LaGray. Can't hear anything. I think you're still muted. Otherwise, we'll come back to you. Like whenever. Okay, yeah. So feel free to reconnect, and I'll just go to the next one and come back to you when you're ready. Okay, Michael.
Hi, John. So you've recommended several times in the past that large sites that they focus on smaller set of pages, I guess. So the site I'm working on right now, we have a lot of pages that a lot of pages, like 1,000 pages that don't get any traffic, that are old. So I've been recommending to remove those. But there's a question that our dev team has that they were under the impression that the more pages that Google has indexed of your site, the higher authority it ascribes to the site, and are reticent to remove any pages. Could you shed some light on that?
Yeah. So it's definitely not the case that if you have more pages indexed that we think your website is better. So I think that at least is absolutely not the case. Sometimes it makes sense to have a lot of pages indexed. Sometimes they're kind of useful pages have index like that, but it's not a sign of quality with regards to like how many pages that are indexed. And especially if you're talking about something in the order of, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 pages, that's a pretty low number for our systems in general. And it's not that we would say, oh, 5,000 pages is better than 1,000 pages. For us, it's all kind of like, well, it's a small website, and we make do with what we can pull out there. And of course, like, small website is relative. It's not like saying it's like an irrelevant website. It might be small, but it might still be very useful. But it's certainly not the case that just having more pages indexed is a sign of quality.
Okay, thank you so much.
Cool. Lagray, maybe we'll try you again.
There, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. This connecting from work and connecting from home is different. Anyway, back in mid-July, we started noticing a lot of errors in Search Console submitted, but no index. The URLs themselves do not have a no index on them, but on the subsequent crawl, they get indexed. The problem is that, you know, we get 300 errors, no index, and then on subsequent crawls, only 5 get crawled before they recrawl, you know, so many more. So given that they are no index, and granted, if things can't render or they can't find a page, they're directed to our page not found, which does have a no index. And so I know somehow they're getting directed there. Is this just a memory issue, or like, since they're able to get subsequently crawled fine, is it just a...
It's hard to say without looking at the pages. So I would really try to double check if this was a problem then and is not a problem anymore, or if it's still something that kind of intermittently happens. Because if it doesn't matter, if it doesn't kind of take place now anymore, then like,
no, it does still take place now. Like, it just, okay, it crawled on 10.4, and then on 10.5 it recrawled again, and the ones that got recrawled were indexed fine. Okay. So I don't know if it's caching it somehow or if it was just a memory issue. I'm not sure.
Yeah, my hunch, without knowing your site, is that something with the rendering is sometimes going wrong, and it's reaching that error page that you mentioned, and if that's something that still takes place, I would try to figure out what might be causing that. And it might be that, like, when you test the page in Search Console, 9 times out of 10 it works well, but kind of that 1 time out of 10 when it doesn't work well and redirects to the error page, or we think it redirects to the error page, that's kind of the case I would try to drill down into and try to figure out, is it that, like, there are too many requests to render this page, or there's something complicated with the JavaScript that sometimes takes too long and sometimes works well, and then try to narrow things down from that point of view.
Okay. So could it be that if there's too much volume, then the pages couldn't be, so many resources are blocked, and so then it looks like page not found, and then when there's less traffic on the website, the resources are able to be rendered?
Could be. Yeah, could be. And I mean, what happens on our side is we crawl the HTML page, mm-hmm, and then we try to process the HTML page in kind of the Chromium, kind of Chrome-type browser. And for that, we try to pull in all of the resources that are mentioned on there. So if you go to the developer console in Chrome, and you look at the network section, it shows you like a waterfall diagram of everything that it loads to render the page. And if there are lots of things that need to be loaded, then it can happen that things time out, and then we might run into that error situation.
Okay.
So that's kind of the direction I would go. And if you can't isolate exactly what is going wrong, then I would try to take the number of requests there and just see if there are ways that you can minimize that. Maybe the developer team can combine the different JavaScript files, or combine the CSS files, minimize the images, or things like that.
OK, cool. Thank you.
Cool. Christian.
Hi, John. It's me again. last time we talked about some problems with a website where we have like an e-commerce website where we have informational stuff and transactional stuff. And your advice was to separate this content a little bit and into transaction-oriented and information-oriented pages. So, but I have another question regarding this. If you have an e-commerce website and you have a huge blog or a magazine or something like that, where you have loads of informational stuff, but it's an own section. And on the other hand, you have all these product pages and categories and so on. So would this huge blog with pure informational stuff give the whole website kind of an informational touch or character so that Google says, oh, we are not sure this is something where people can get information rather than buying stuff? Or is this evaluation done on a per page base?
I don't think we have that documented or defined, but my understanding is that this is more of a page level thing. Because it's just purely from trying to think of it as, I don't know, a practical way, like how you would implement it and look at websites overall. A lot of websites just have a mix of different kinds of content, and then you try to figure out which of these pages match the searcher's intent, and try to rank those appropriately. So, my feeling is this is something more that would be on a page level rather than on a website level.
Okay, so we don't have the have the risk that by adding more and more text content that we kind of dilute the product pages or something.
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, you see that with news websites often, that they have kind of the recent events, but they also have sections for maybe like older events that took place, I don't know, 9/11, or for other big events. They kind of have an isolated archive section. And those are very different intents. Like if you want something really now that is happening, or if you want some kind of informational research evergreen type content. And there too, we kind of have to look at it on a per page basis and not like say, oh, this is a research website because there's some research content here.
All right, cool. Thanks a lot, John.
Cool. Let's see, Kai Shi. I don't know how to pronounce your name. I'm sorry.
Just Kai.
Kai. Yeah. Okay.
Short name. Okay. So John, I have this question for you. We are seeing that people are linking to us through backlinks to our, let's say, subcategory pages, and the problem is that after some time, our content and comes and goes, which means that sometimes there is more content appearing in some categories. Sometimes the content gets deleted, and so subcategories can be created and can disappear as well. And we are seeing a bunch of 404s from backlinks because they are linking to subcategories that no longer exist. My question here is it okay to redirect these people, these links to the parent category? And if we do so, how do we do that? With 302, for example, like a temporary redirect, because in the future, this subcategory might be populated with content again, or it's kind of, it's not a permanent redirect,
So if we see this happening at a larger scale, that you redirect kind of to the parent level, we would probably see that as a soft 404. And we would say, well, the old page is gone. And like instead of a 404 code, you're redirecting, and maybe that's better for users. But we see it as a 404.
Okay.
So from a practical point of view, I suspect there's little SEO difference if you redirect or not. If it makes sense from a user point of view to redirect, then I would just go for it. It's not that you have a penalty either way. Okay. So that's kind of the first thing. With regards to 301 or 302, I don't think it matters there, because we would either see this as a soft 404, or we would see it as a canonicalization question. If it's a soft 404, then the code doesn't matter. If it's a canonicalization question, then it comes down to which URL we show in the search results. And usually, the higher level one will have stronger signals anyway, and we will focus on the higher level one.
Yeah.
So that doesn't matter if that's a 301 or a 302 in that case.
My follow-up question to this is basically if we do, because we do think it's better for the user to see the category page instead of a blank page, let's say, because the parent category is usually very strongly related to the subcategory. So, but my concern here is if we do this kind of redirection, I don't know if it could impact future crawling of the subcategory when the subcategory appears again, let's say, okay? Because as I said, content can come in again in the subcategory, but if we did a redirect to the parent in the past, Google maybe, I don't know, maybe it doesn't crawl anymore that subcategory. That's my follow-up concern.
Yeah. I suspect there's a minimal difference, but I don't know which one would be better. So that's kind of the first thing, because if we see it as a soft 404, it would be like a 404. And we would slow down crawling of that particular URL, because like there's nothing here. Why do we have to crawl it every day? If we see it as a redirect, then we would also say, well, we don't need to crawl this every day because we focus on the primary URL. So I think in both of those cases, we would slow down crawling of that URL until we get new signals that tell us, actually, this is maybe something new again. Whoa. And the new signals, I think that would be the stronger sign. That would be like internal linking or sitemap file, things like that.
Okay.
And that would be the stronger sign for us to crawl again. But I think the slowing down of crawling would be similar in all of these cases. It might be like maybe there's a minimal difference between some of them, but I don't know which one would be faster, for example.
But if we include them again in the sitemaps, that should be enough to let Google know, hey, maybe take a look at this.
Yeah, I think sitemaps alone is probably not enough. I would really make sure that the internal linking is also clear.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much.
Granite.
Hey, John.
Hi.
So about a year ago, we saw some significant decrease in traffic. After the audit, we kind of all the signals pointed to the site having site quality issues. We were able to address those issues by February this year. And by June core update, we saw some increases. But it's still not to the level where we used to be before the decrease about a year ago. So my question is, like, the site quality issues, if that's been the case, is this the recovery that we can expect, or can we expect more recovery if we think we've addressed all the issues identified? Or, like, is this it?
I think the tricky part here is it's not so much that we would consider it as a situation where you have to fix something, but rather when it comes to relevance, if you work on improving the relevance of your website, then you have a different website. You have a better website. So it's not that we would switch back and say, oh, it's like the issue is fixed and we will change it back to the previous state. But rather, you're saying, well, this is a better website now. And we look at it and say, oh, it's a better website. it's not the same or comparable to before. So it would be kind of tricky to expect that it changes to the state it was before. But it's a new website. It's a better website. So that's something where when I think, especially with core updates, when you're talking about recovery, it's not so much you're recovering, but rather Google is seeing that you have a better website and reacting to that.
Understood. And when we talk about site quality issues, I think like from what we've been able to see, those were like mostly, let's say, technical and user experience issues and not like content quality issues, meaning that content-wise, I think we are very solid, but we had more ads than you should have on a page, and that's been addressed. And overall, the user experience has been improved, which like all the audits and everything that we did like pointed out that for those to be the reason.
Yeah, I think it's kind of tricky because with the core updates, we don't focus so much on just individual issues, but rather like the relevance of the website overall. And that can include things like the usability and the ads on a page, but it's essentially the website overall. And usually that also means kind of the focus of the content, the way you're presenting things, the way you're making it clear to users what's behind the content, like where what the sources are, all of these things. All of that kind of plays in. So just going in and changing like everything around the content, I think you can probably get some improvements there. But essentially, if you really want Google to see your website as something significantly better, you probably also need to work on the content side. And at least from the focus point of view, and think about like where might there be low quality content, where might users be confused when they go to my website, and is that confusion something we can address with technical issues, with UX changes, or do we actually have to change some of the content that we present?
Understood. And my last question would be, if that drop came not during a core update, but like a regular period of time, like should you expect for the core updates to happen for you to see a recovery if you are addressing issues, or should you expect also recoveries to happen in a non-core update period?
I think if you make bigger changes on a website, regardless, you would see kind of a subtle change over time as we reprocess things and re-understand the signals. And if there was something from the core update that was significantly impacting it as well, then you would see a jump during the core update. But at least you should see kind of that subtle improvement over time.
Understood. Thank you.
Cool. Kamar. Oh my, good. We have two that are almost the same. Go
good
ahead.
Good morning. I hope this is the right Kamar.
Yes.
Thank you, John. So my first, my video is off because I'm having some bandwidth issues. My first question, all my questions are small and they're around anchor text. So when we are writing a page on our own website and we curate content, for example, from WebMD, we are taking a snippet and using it as a point of reference. And if we were to give a citation to WebMD, in other words, source URL, I prefer to use it in the footer. So when the person is reading it, they don't jump off within the article and jump off to WebMD to learn more. So my user stays on the site. Now, there are two thoughts. Should we give a link back to WebMD or should we not? Because I have not found a reference anywhere that Google wants you to link back. You know, so why should I give any more link that WebMD has that, you know, et cetera? So that was my first question. What's the best practice from a Google point of view?
I think if you're quoting something, then linking to the source always makes sense. So that's kind of just purely from a usability point of view, I think that would make sense. Mm-hmm. With regards to SEO for your website, I don't know if you would see any particular change by specifically linking to other people's websites, because it's one of those also spammy techniques that used to be used quite a bit, where you would create a low quality page and on the bottom you would link to CNN and Google and Wikipedia. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then you would hope, well, Google thinks this is a good page because it links to CNN. But
and yeah, and that's the reason I was talking about linking. I gave a reference to WebMD, their authority, but when we are linking to somebody, there are some legal issues from an FTC guideline that when you link, you are kind of giving recommendation, and the user might think, okay, I'm going to click here and do something. And then I have received letters from lawyers, hey, stop linking to us because we don't want to be linked. So that's why I have not linked to people.
Okay.
So I wanted to know from an SEO perspective. Now, the second thing is, if I have a content that is off page, in other words, I wrote a piece of content on LinkedIn and I'm connecting back to my website. And the question is about anchor text. So from an SEO mindset, I can say, okay, I want to link back to my, if my page talks about SEO services, I can use an anchor text to learn more, check my SEO services page. Now that's a anchor text that worries me, because while it's a great anchor text that would benefit me, from a web accessibility point of view, that's the kind of link I should use, you know. But from an SEO, it's like over optimization coming back to me. So how do I handle that, you know, coming back? Because there are risks levels, you know.
I mean, usually what happens is we look at the web and we find all kinds of links. Mm-hmm. If you're creating content on multiple platforms, I would try to use useful anchor mm-hmm. text that gives us more mm-hmm. information about the page that you're linking to. So if that's like an anchor text that includes SEO services or mm-hmm. whatever, I think that's perfectly fine, because usually we have a wide variety of things kind of linking mm-hmm. around, and some of them will be kind of like, click this page and that's the anchor text, and others will have more information about the link. I wouldn't necessarily kind of like over worry about mm-hmm. using a good anchor text. Instead, like I would try to use good anchor text and like link to your content so that it's clear what that content is. Also with internal linking, the same thing, and mm-hmm. not say like, well, I need to vary my anchor text, or I need to make it look like it's not optimized, because like with internal linking, users want to know what this link is about, and you want to give that context. So I would just include that context.
Right. So my point of view of the link is that link is contextual. So wherever I'm linking, I want user to click there and find the right information. Yeah. With the clicked link, you know, doesn't matter. So, and that brings to the third problem. So when it's on LinkedIn, it's more trusted, you know, it's coming back. But now there's a third problem, is people are doing guest posts all over, you know, they're going to these low quality sites, they're buying guest posts. So how does Google determine? And it's like you said, if it's a good anchor text, use it, right? Now, if it's a guest post and Google does not know whether it's paid or not, how will Google then determine that, take this link or burn this link? You know, what is the answer? So we are safe from all the angles.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a guest post, then mm-hmm. it's a guest post. And our guidance for links in guest posts is that they should be nofollow. So if you're writing these guest posts to drive awareness to your business, mm-hmm. I think that's perfectly fine. I will just really watch out to make sure that the links are nofollow, mm-hmm. so that you're driving awareness, you're talking about what you're doing, you're making it so that users can go to your page. But essentially, it's an ad for your business. So from that point of view, I would just make them nofollow. With regards to guest posts in general, like how does Google recognize guest posts? I think that's tricky, because we use lots of different signals to try to figure out what might be a guest post and how we might need to handle that. But it's definitely not the case that it's just like the link anchor text is what makes it problematic.
OK, got it. Thank you so much. That's all.
Sure. Okay. Let me just take a quick break with the live questions and go through some of the submitted ones so that we don't lose track. Stay tuned, like hang around. We'll get to you. Don't worry. Let's see. I think the first one is an interesting one that I got is it's basically, historically speaking, SEOs have owned title tags. And recently, Google prefers to show H1 instead of the title tags. And you have to consider that the H1 is a product of a multi-departmental discussion, which might not be exactly what the SEO team wants. Why are you rewriting SEO titles when you do not do the same for ad titles? Why do you do this to SEOs? It's like, so on the one hand, I don't know what happens on the PPC or on the ad side, so I can't really speak for that. But in general, I think it's a kind of a tricky mindset to say that SEOs own one particular part of the page, and that is always mapped one-to-one in this part of the search results, because these things change over time. And it's something like the structured data that is processed can change over time. In the past, it was that you would use microdata and things that are embedded within the HTML for structured data. Now, a lot of people use JSON-LD, which is kind of separate. But all of these things, they evolve over time. It's not the case that you can always say, for any given HTML page, this is exactly what the SEO will do, and this is exactly what the developers will do and what the content team will do. These things just evolve over time. So from my point of view, it's not so much that we're doing this to annoy the SEOs, but rather we're trying to improve the quality of the search results so that ultimately, people search more. And when people search more, they go to your websites more. That's kind of essentially our goals here. So it's not the case that people at Google sit around and go like, oh, like how can I annoy SEOs this week? That's definitely not what we do, what we spend our time on. We have so many other normal business problems and work problems and technical problems to work on. And we try to improve the quality of our services. And sometimes that affects what SEOs do. Sometimes that doesn't. And when it does affect what SEOs do, we do try to let you know about these kind of changes. I think the submitted no index, we talked about that briefly. Let's see. If there are two competing e-commerce sites that sell exactly the same product, one website offers a product at $500, the other at $100, all SEO signals are equal. Would the less expensive website have a better chance of ranking because there's such a price difference for the exact same product? So purely from a web search point of view, no. It's not the case that we would try to recognize a price on a page and use that as a ranking factor. So it's not the case that we would say we'll take the cheaper one and rank that higher. I don't think that would really make sense. However, a lot of these products also end up in kind of the product search results, which could be because you submit a feed, or it could be because we recognize the product information on these pages. And the product search results, I don't know how they're ordered. It might be that they take the price into account, or things like availability, all of the other factors that kind of come in as attributes into product search. So from a web search point of view, we don't take the price into account. From a product search point of view, it's possible. And the tricky part, I think, as an SEO, is these different aspects of search are often combined in one search results page, where you'll see normal web results, and maybe you'll see some product results on the side, or maybe you'll see some mix of that. So that's kind of looking at that. If we have 200 sitemap files and 20 to 30% of the URLs jump from one file to another every week, how bad can it be? Or should we strictly keep our URLs in the same file forever? So how bad can it be is like hard to say, because we don't really have a measure for badness when it comes to sitemap files. But we would generally try to, or our recommendation is usually to keep the same URL in the same sitemap file. The main reason for that is we process sitemap files at different rates. So if you move one URL from one second file to another, it might be that we have the same URL in our systems from multiple sitemap files suddenly. And if you have different information for this one URL, like different change dates, for example, then we would not know which attribute to actually use. So from that point of view, if you have it always in the same sitemap file, then it's a lot easier for us to say, oh, we have the information for this URL here. And we can trust that information because it's only there. So that's something where I try to avoid it, like these URLs shuffling around randomly. But at the same time, it's usually not going to break processing of your sitemap file. And it's definitely not going to have a ranking effect on your website. So there's nothing in our sitemap system that kind of maps to the quality of a website. I'm learning SEO from multiple sources, and it feels like a behemoth of information. Do you have a preferred SEO checklist that will help make the workflow more efficient? This is in regards to launching a website for small businesses or helping existing businesses boost their SEO. Yeah, I don't think we have any SEO checklists, so that makes it a little bit harder to get started. What I would recommend doing is looking at the various SEO starter guides that are out there. So we have an SEO starter guide. They're from various SEO tools. There are also starter guides available that are usually pretty good. And for the most part, the starter guides that I've seen, they have correct information. So it's, I think, a lot less the case that people publish something incorrect when it comes to especially the beginning side of SEO. So I would try to go through those and think about which aspects actually play a role or matter for your website. The tricky part, I think, with all of these starter guides, at least the ones that I've seen, is they're often based on an almost old school model of websites where you create HTML pages. And for the most part, small businesses, when they go online, they don't create HTML pages anymore. They go into WordPress or into Wix or into any of the other common hosting platforms. And they create their pages by putting text in and dragging images in and all of these things. And they don't really realize that in the back, there's actually an HTML page. So sometimes when you go through these starter guides, it can feel very technical and not really map to what you're actually doing when you're creating these web pages. Because when we talk about title elements, for example, you don't look at the HTML anymore and try to tweak that, but rather you try to find the field in your whatever hosting system that you have and think about what you need to put there. So that's something where I think over time, things will probably shift a little bit to kind of cover that area a little bit better. But it's something to kind of keep in mind, that the SEO starter guides, when you look at them, they might feel like super technical. But actually, the work that you do is a lot more like filling in fields and making sure that the links are there and things like that. Let's see. I work in the news vertical. My team is looking to expand our international presence and have done work to set up multi-regional subdirectories. For the most part, pages across the different multi-regional editions will look the same. Homepage and section pages, like politics or lifestyle, will have similar content, minus a few pieces unique to the region. The articles are tricky. There is not much we can differentiate across multi-regional subdirectories outside of modules with, let's see, related links, which leaves us worried that duplicate content issues. How does Google handle duplicate content in the news space? Is it acceptable? The content stays the same, but elements of the template are different. Should there only be one canonical across all multi-regional websites? Wow, OK. Lots of different aspects there. So I think taking a step back first, it sounds like these are different regions within the same country. And it's same language content. So for example, I don't know, different US states or different regions within the UK, for example, something like that. If these are different countries, then you have the aspect of geotargeting, which plays a role. If these are different languages, so if you're working, say, in Europe, and you're covering Germany and France and Italy or something like that, then you have different languages as well. that's also a very different aspect. But if you're talking about within the same country, same language content, then on the one hand, it's a little bit easier because you don't have to worry about all of these technical connections. But on the other hand, the duplicate content issues are a lot more visible. And when it comes to duplicate content, the tricky aspect on sites like these is that you essentially end up competing with yourself. And if you have one news article that you publish across, I don't know, 5 or 6 different regional websites, then all of these different regional websites try to rank for exactly the same article. And that could result in that article just not ranking as well as it otherwise could. So because of that, I would recommend trying to find canonical URLs for these individual articles so that you can really say, well, I have this one article on my 5 regional websites, but this is my preferred version that I want to have seen in search. And then we can concentrate all of our energy, all of our signals on that one preferred version, and we can try to rank that one a little bit better. It doesn't have to be the same version all the time. So it can definitely be the case that you have one news article that is within one region, kind of the canonical, and different news article is more canonical for another region. How you pick which region you choose as canonical is totally up to you. It can be completely random if you want, but usually you would try to figure out like where is it the most relevant and pick that one as the canonical version. So that's for, I think, the individual articles themselves. For the categories and the sections and the home pages, it seems like that would be something where the content is more unique and more specific to the individual regions. And because of that, I would try to just keep those indexable separate. So if you have 5 different regional websites, their homepage, their category sections, they would all be individually indexed. And the news articles themselves would be mapped to one of these different regions. So that's kind of the approach that we recommend there. People do it in lots of different variations. And this approach also, just I guess if you're curious, also works across different domain names. So if you have different domains for individual regions, but it's all a part of the same news group, you can still do kind of this canonical shifting across the different versions. If you're doing it within the same domain with subdirectories, that's fine too. Let's see, HTML semantics versus SEO optimization. The question kind of goes into like on e-commerce product pages, should the title of the product be marked up as a heading. And from our point of view, that's totally up to you. From purely a technical point of view, it can be the case that the product is a heading on a page. I think that makes sense in a lot of cases because you have kind of your business maybe as a heading. You have the product or the kind of product that it is as a heading. That seems to make total sense from a semantic point of view. So that's kind of what I would focus on there. So less trying to squeeze kind of semantics into what works well for SEO, but rather trying to do what makes sense from a semantic HTML point of view. And usually that maps fairly well to search as well. Is Google Discover's personalization based on Google Search only or also on YouTube and other Google products? I didn't know offhand. So I looked at the Help Center content for Google Discover, and it mentions that it's essentially based on the searches that you do. So you have to enable, I think, whatever the feature is that enables the search history in your account so that that works. And that kind of suggests to me that it's based on your search history. I don't know how like the other Google products map into that. My assumption is just purely from a data protection point of view, it would be tricky to map kind of other products into something like that. So I kind of doubt that is happening. What is the best course of action to take when you have to 301 redirect all of the URLs to a new set of URLs? The number of pages will be over 1 million, and you want to minimize the sandbox effect. If there is a sandbox effect, how long could it be? Would we lose ranking that we might never recover? We plan on doing a one-to-one redirect and had requested batch redirects, but that's not a possibility. So pages, images, URLs, et cetera, would have to flip at the same time. To me, this sounds like a traditional site move situation. You move from one domain to another, and you redirect all of the URLs from your old site to a new one. And we have to deal with that. And there's, at least from my point of view, there's nothing like a sandbox effect. There is definitely nothing defined as a sandbox effect on our side when it comes to site moves. So if you have to do a site move, then do a site move. Then redirect all of your pages. It's often like the easiest approach is just to redirect all pages at once. Our systems are also tuned to that a little bit to try to recognize that. So when we see that a website starts redirecting all pages to a different website, then we'll try to reprocess that a little bit faster so that we can process that site move as quickly as possible. And it's definitely not the case that we would say, oh, they're doing a site move, therefore we will slow things down. But rather, we try to process things actually a little bit faster when we recognize there is a site move. I have a website that connects to APIs on the client side to get data. Are those URLs being included in the crawling budget? If you disallow those URLs, would that create any issues? So I think there are two things here. On the one hand, if these APIs are included when a page is rendered, then yes, they would be included in the crawling. And they would count towards your site, but your crawl budget, essentially, because we have to crawl those URLs to render the page. You can block them by robots.txt if you prefer that they're not crawled or not used during rendering. Totally up to you if you prefer doing that, especially if you have an API that is kind of costly to maintain or takes a lot of resources, then sometimes that makes sense. The tricky part, I guess, is if you disallow crawling of your API endpoint, we won't be able to use any data that the API returns for indexing. So if your page's content comes purely from the API and you disallow crawling of the API, we won't have that content. That's kind of the one aspect there. If the API just does something supplementary to the page, like maybe draws a map or, I don't know, like a graphic of a numeric table that you have on a page or something like that, then maybe it doesn't matter if that content isn't included in indexing. The other thing is that sometimes it's non-trivial how a page functions when the API is blocked. In particular, if you use JavaScript and the API calls are blocked because of robots.txt, then like you have to handle that exception somehow. And depending on how you embed the JavaScript on the page, what you do with the API, you need to make sure that it still works. So if that API call doesn't work and then the rest of the page's rendering breaks completely, then like we can't index much because there's nothing left to render. However, if the API call breaks and we can still index the rest of your page, then that might be perfectly fine. So those are kind of the options there. I think it's trickier if you run an API for other people, because if you disallow crawling then you kind of have this second order effect that someone else's website might be dependent on your API. And depending on what your API does, then suddenly their website doesn't have indexable content. And they might not even notice because they weren't aware that suddenly you added a disallow there. And that might cause kind of like indirect effects. But that's ultimately all up to you. Cool. OK. Still a bunch of questions submitted, but also lots of people's hands. Maybe I'll go back to some hands until we kind of finish the recording here. And I also have some more time afterwards, so we can try to answer all of the questions. Kumar.
Hi, John. So hi. John, I have also added my question, the main question that I had on the question list on YouTube channel. So I'll repeat the question. So there are two pages that originate from the same domain the URL is a bit different. Basically, they're part of the same directory structure. And the way they are generated by Next.js. So Next.js is a server-side rendered React framework. And they are being indexed, but I see one page in the Google cache, and the second page is not in the Google cache. And I see the same pattern regardless of how I generate the page. Okay, and I mean, there is no set pattern that this would be in Google cache, this would not be in Google cache. Most of my pages are in Google cache, but now I'm worried because I'm currently moving from my Java-based tech stack, which generates all these pages, to total Next.js. And this problem is, while I was debugging, I found that this is also a problem with the older Java stack that we were using. So the question is two parts, basically, why this behavior? And second is, will this behavior impact my ranking? I see those pages appearing in search results, okay, which are not in Google cache, web cache. But will it impact my rankings? Okay, I have another question, but this is important.
Okay. So first of all, the cache pages are completely separated from what we index.
Okay.
So if there is a cache page or not, it doesn't matter at all for ranking. It doesn't matter at all for indexing. Sometimes there are technical reasons why we don't have a cache page. Sometimes we just don't have a cache page for individual URLs. The other thing is if the page is using a JavaScript framework, then whether or not that JavaScript runs on a cache page is sometimes tricky. Because the cache page is hosted on a Google domain, depending on what kind of JavaScript you have, where it pulls the JavaScript files in, sometimes the JavaScript can't run on the kind of Google domain. And from that point of view, if you look at the cache page, then it can look like, oh, it's an empty page. And maybe Google is indexing an empty page. But that doesn't mean that we would index an empty page. It's just, well, the JavaScript can't run on this page. Because the cache page is not the rendered page. It is essentially just the HTML file that we requested and a copy of that. And if the HTML file shows something, that's fine. If it uses JavaScript and the JavaScript doesn't run because it's a cache page, that's equally fine. You just don't see it in the cache page.
So John, the challenge is when I search this in Google Web Cache, right? I get a 404. Google tells me that this page is not in the cache. So typical 404 page that you see for web page in the domain, right? So and the same page, okay? The structure of the same, the JavaScript file, the structure, everything is same in the URLs that I've given in the question. Okay, the structure and everything is same. It's just the content that is varying. Are you saying that because while Google was indexing and was requesting that HTML, there was a problem with JavaScript? That's why it did not cache. What could be the reason? I just want to get to the bottom of this because I have around 100,000 categories which I need to enable, then corresponding to 100,000 categories, around 200,000 products that I need to enable. And although what you said is correct, my SEO team has said that this won't matter. Okay, but it is still a problem for me. Something that I don't understand is a problem. I cannot find a reason, and it's giving me ABGBs, if you understand.
Yeah, the cache page, I would not worry about it at all. It's a completely separate system at Google. So we have kind of the system for indexing and ranking, and the system for cache pages is completely separate. So if the cache page doesn't show, I would not worry about that. That's not a sign of any issue. And often it's also something you can't control if there's a cache page or not. So I would just ignore that.
OK, sounds good to me. Second is around dynamic rendering. So before we move to Next.js, we had a regular React application. I am more of a tech guy. I'm not an XE expert. But then going through certain articles on developers.google.com, I found that there is a headless browser tool called RenderTron. Maybe you have heard about it, right? So looking at that tool, does it mean that I don't need to look at server-side rendering frameworks like Next.js, where Google is also investing a lot of money, right? Google sponsors Next.js. So should I stop looking at this and should I simply get React, generate my single page application, and then use RenderTron for when Google bots hit me, I redirect that traffic to RenderTron, which will serve them the rendered page. That is okay.
I can't give you advice like which approach would be better, because I think it depends a lot on the different factors that are around your website. However, mm-hmm. I would strongly recommend you join one of Martin's office hours. So Martin on my team does JavaScript-based office hours. I think every other week or once a month, something like that. I would watch out for those and join one of those and ask him directly and see if he can take a look at your site, maybe some of the specifics from your pages, and if he can give you some more specific advice there.
So because I mean,
technically, these approaches should both work. It's not that one works and the other one doesn't, or that one is better than the other. But it might be that one is easier in your specific case.
OK, mine is an e-commerce website. But OK, what you're saying is I'll join Martin's office hours. Yeah. That's all I had, John. And thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks. Cool. Good luck. Anna.
Hi, John. Nice to see you. For the first time. As you might seen, I have a question on the YouTube site. The thing is that we have in Google Search Console two domains, and like in September, everything was working fine as the Google Search Console only save last 16 months, right? And for some reason, like in the other domain, it just saved like in that console only 12 months. I thought it was just like maybe the website or reporting problem, but we have also a connection to export those data to Kepula, and we also seen those changes there that it's saving just 12 months. And I'm not sure who else should I contact because we don't have any local support in Czech Republic.
Yeah, I don't think you can change that. So that's kind of the first problem. Usually, this comes from a situation where the website was verified before and lost verification, mm-hmm. and then was verified again. And probably like 12 months ago was maybe when the verification happened again. And usually when the website loses all verification, then we stop processing the data, and we start processing again when it's verified again. Whereas if a website was never verified at all, then we try to recreate all of the old data. So it's kind of a, I don't know, one of those situations where you're stuck essentially with the data that you have available there. It's not that you can recreate that old data. What you could try, I don't know if it works, is to try to verify a subsection of your website. So if you have a subdirectory or a subdomain, or instead of doing the domain verification, doing the specific host name verification, see if that will trigger kind of like regenerating the rest of the data. Usually you would just have to kind of, I don't know, keep it as is, and in the future, like it'll fill up again to the 18 months, but it won't regenerate the old data.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I forgot to mention, I'm a web analyst, and like my colleague is the guy from SEO. So I think that if I told him that to try to verify those subdomains, then he should know what to do.
Yeah. Usually it's easy to just add those separately. But I can't guarantee that it'll regenerate the data. I think it should, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, this change we've noticed, like it happened maybe like 2 weeks ago, and on September everything was working fine. We've seen like the last six month data, but like in this month everything like those 4 months just disappeared. So that's why I have this question.
Yeah, it's annoying. I wish it's something that we would handle differently in Search Console, but yeah, at the moment it's not something that you can kind of like recreate, force it to recreate that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. That's all. Thank you for your
cool. All right. Answers. Thanks a lot. Cool. I will take a break here with the recording, and I'll still be here for more of the questions. It looks like a bunch of hands are still up. If you're watching this on YouTube, thanks for sticking around to the end. If you'd like to join one of these in the future, watch out in the community section on our channel for the next versions of the office hours. And with that, let me take a break here and hope to see you all again in one of the future ones.